So it's 3, 2, 1. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Shadow Talk, a weekly cyber threat intelligence and information security weekly podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest Photon Intelligence team. I am Stefano, and I'm glad to be back another week hosting this podcast. And today we've got Kim on the line. Hi, Kim. How's it going?
Hello. Good, thank you.
Nice to have you back. And then we've got a new entry. So there's Brian here in the line as well. Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So Brian is at his first appearance on the Shadow Talk podcast. So do you want to give a brief introduction about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hey, guys. So my name is Brian Kelly. I started off here in Orkia about 3 years ago. I started off in the security analyst position. And then within about a year and a half, I moved over to the threat hunting team, working alerts with our teammates and kind of collaborating, kind of really brought up an interest in incident response and obviously CTI. And then obviously as threats went on and got more sophisticated, the interest grew and grew and grew. And then I seen the way the threat hunting team was going. So I was mad not to jump into the team or at least throw my hand at it.
Cool. Perfect. Well, welcome you, Brian. Your expertise will, I'm sure it's going to help us a lot as we try to sort of move Shadow Talk from a purely strategic podcast to a blend of strategic and technical and tactical analysis of what we're seeing on the threat landscape. So really good to have you on board. So today we're going to have three main topics that we're going to discuss. The first one is going to be about the sanctions imposed to TrickBot and Conti members. Then we're going to talk about malicious OneNote attachments. And finally, we're going to take a look at the distributed denial of service attacks against NATO entities' web pages. So as always, if you have any questions for the team or if you're curious about anything in particular, feel free to reach out to ShadowTalk at digitalshadows.com if you have any questions, and we're going to be happy to answer all of them as soon as possible. So since we've got a quite packed agenda, let's start with the first topic. And that's going to be about the TrickBot Conti sanctions. So what happened? So at the beginning of this week or the ending of last week, I can't remember exactly, but well, in the past few days, the US and the UK have issued sanctions against 7 members of the cybercriminal group responsible for the TrickBot malware and the Conti ransomware strain. So what is... There's a lot of interesting things to talk about when we're discussing the sanctions, but one of the main things is that this was the first time that the UK issued this sort of sanctions for cyber criminal actors. And the 7 individuals have been associated with development and deployment of a range of different malware strains, including ransomware that targeted both the US and UK among pretty large number of Western countries. The roles played by these individuals varied, but some of them have been assessed to be with ties to the Russian intelligence services. So, Kim, can you tell us something about TrickBot and the importance of this malware for the wider cybercriminal environment, please?
Sure. So TrickBot was first observed in 2016, I think. So it's been running for quite a long time. And it started life as a banking Trojan, so similar to like Emotet, and was quite a successful banking Trojan. And it had been developed based on the code for the Dire banking Trojan that had been running for some time before that. But so as it was developed, TrickBot then became a modular malware in its own right. So the malware was then starting to drop other payloads. So I think it first began dropping the Ryuk ransomware, and then later we saw the ties with Conti ransomware, and also the Diabol ransomware was linked with TrickBot as well. But so there's kind of like a move into capitalizing on that ever popular ransomware scene that we've also been talking about, but TrickBot is still operating as a malware in its own right. Recently this year, in line with the Russia-Ukraine war, TrickBot has been observed targeting Ukrainian entities. So being a banking Trojan and having those banking Trojan roots, TrickBot has always been kind of a financially motivated tool used in financially motivated attacks. But that was a real shift into kind of like suggesting it those ties to the intelligence services that you mentioned, like operating on behalf of the Russian state, like targeting Ukraine, being all in line with that. So that's kind of part of its importance of it being used for kind of espionage-ish activities. But also, it was one of the first malware to really begin that kind of dropping of infection chain. So using the TrickBot compromises to drop ransomware.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things for me about TrickBot is the fact that since I've started working in this industry, I've seen TrickBot appearing everywhere, like every week, or like linking with different kind of malwares and threat groups, like signaling the really huge role played by this malware in facilitating other kind of attacks too. So that was really interesting for me. And what you mentioned, that we said also before about like the Russian ties that it may have. It's interesting because right now we're seeing a lot of sort of blurring lines between what before was just like strictly financially motivated and now maybe ideologically or politically motivated, which is one of the main impacts of the Russia-Ukraine war on the cyber threat landscape, I'd say. Because a lot of these groups that are like that have some associations with Russia that are targeting Ukrainian entities right now. We, of course, cannot know if they are, I don't know, state-sponsored or state-encouraged or state-tolerated. So it will be interesting to see also how this will evolve in the future. But yeah, right now, these seven individuals have been sanctioned by the UK and the US. And my questions for you right now would be to sort of explain how these sanctions work, what do they aim to do against these individuals, and what are some of the possible unintended consequences that they can bring to the table.
Yeah, so I think sanctions when it comes to cybercrime are a real tool when we are discussing Russian cybercrime. They're another tool in a government's armory for if more traditional like law enforcement steps can't work. So, with Russian cybercriminals staying within the confines of Russia, it's very difficult to elicit arrests or searches of houses when they're in a state. A country that doesn't cooperate with Western law enforcement doesn't have any sort of extradition treaty. So the sanctions, they basically put these individuals on a list and they become designated persons. And it makes being on this sanctions list makes it illegal to make a financial payment to anybody on that list. Like it's a criminal offence, you could be charged for it. And it also imposes like asset freezes against those individuals. So kind of any banks around the world that facilitate financial payments for those individuals can also face criminal proceedings, fines, like being reported to their regulatory bodies. And then the individuals on those lists as well also have travel bans imposed on them. So if they do travel to any country that is friendly to the US and the UK, then they can be arrested upon their arrival there. So that really is probably the main difference in this case, where we've got the US and the UK imposing the sanctions, because it means that financial and that travel reach is that much wider with both of those organizations, both of those countries
Yeah.
leading the sanctions.
I'm also thinking that it sort of exposed them to like to the wider public, because like right now we know the names and the faces of most of the seven individuals, which may not make a huge difference in their daily life as much as the factors that you mentioned, but still for a cyber criminal to be widely known and publicly known like that cannot be that good.
No. And like everyone likes to go on holiday. Criminals are no exception.
Yeah.
But they will just have to frequent the lovely beaches in Russia from now on.
Yeah, especially if you make that kind of money, and probably the only thing you wanted to do was be on holiday for the rest of your life. No tropical beaches for the moment, I'm afraid. And so this is what the sanctions aim to do. But what are some of the potential unintended consequences that these sanctions can trigger?
I think the kind of consequences, unintended or not, are for victims of Conti ransomware and of TrickBot malware. Because, as I mentioned, making a payment to these individuals is now a criminal offence. So if you are hit with a ransomware that is linked to any of these seven individuals, and by proxy, really, that whole group. So the group is has been named Wizard Spider by CrowdStrike. So that Wizard Spider group really becomes a bit of a difficult entity to be dealing with, because you don't know which of those seven individuals you might be dealing with. But so anyway, it kind of takes paying a ransom off the table, which means that if you haven't got a data backup to work from, then the chances of getting your data back and getting your business up and running are a lot slimmer than they would have been. Obviously, governments don't recommend paying a ransom because it's funding criminality anyway, but we know that some organizations pay it because they don't have any other choice. So there's that. And there's also the sanctions specifically mention that you can't even pay by cryptocurrency. So that opens up a whole other avenue of problems, because cryptocurrency is there to provide anonymity, right? So how do you, as an organization, exercise enough due diligence to show that you are not paying a sanctioned entity? Can cause some real complications. But there are those mitigating factors that, if you have executed due diligence, if you have kept up to date with cyber playbooks, that kind of thing, if you are working with law enforcement, if you are hit with a ransomware attack, then all those are kind of mitigating factors. So if you do unintentionally pay money to a sanctioned entity, then those work in your favor.
Yep, that makes sense. Thank you very much. And so, Brian, I was interested in hearing your thoughts on this, because, like, as I mentioned, working in the cyber threat intelligence, like, strategic space, I encountered TrickBot basically every week doing something malicious with some malicious group. Has that been your experience as well? Like, how did you what's been your experience as a threat hunter for TrickBot?
Yeah, so thankfully, I suppose in recent times, we haven't seen a hell of a lot of activity tied to TrickBot, or we haven't dealt with major kind of incidents tied to TrickBot itself. I did see over the last, I'd say, while it has definitely trickled down, and that's not as active as it used to be. I think with obviously the sanctions are obviously going to make that things a lot better for us, as we're not going to be dealing with as much. But obviously, as well, with the recent changes with Microsoft. Like, blocking the macros, which the execution chain of TrickBot did heavily rely on the likes of those Word or Excel files with embedded macros in the execution chain. So that's kind of taken a good bit off of it. But we've also seen the likes of, say, compromised websites being used where users could navigate to it, they're redirected, and they either download payloads of TrickBot or the Rig Exploit Kit, and so on. So thankfully, we haven't seen a hell of a lot of it. But with that, every other loader will quieten down and it will return. You will likely see it again with additional extended loading capabilities. So
That's a great point.
I wouldn't be surprised if we did see it again.
No, me neither, for sure. And like as Kim mentioned at the beginning, it's like a modular malware, so it can just take some components and change them over time, which makes it like pretty favorable in terms of like persistence in the threat landscape.
Exactly. And on that as well, we did see slight developments which TrickBot leveraged HTML smuggling, which is literally sending an email with an HTML attachment And that kind of abuses, obviously, HTML and JavaScript in order to download additional payloads, whether that be like a disk image, like an ISO file or a zip, and then the execution chain goes on from there.
Cool. So now that I have you and we're talking about malicious attachments, I think this is a great segue into the second section of this week. So we're going to be talking about OneNote malicious attachments, because in the past weeks, a lot of organizations worldwide have been warned of an increase in the number of attacks abusing exactly Microsoft OneNote documents for malware delivery. As you know, OneNote is used by a lot of organizations and individuals for taking notes and managing tasks and all these kind of productivity tasks. And so in short, like in its essence, what happens is the same thing that happens with other Office entities such as Word or PowerPoint. So a user is tricked into opening a malicious file, enabled editing, so enabling the macros that you mentioned before, and then resulting in an execution of a malicious code. In December 2022 and January 2023, security researchers observed more than 50 malicious campaigns abusing OneNote documents, with a lot of remote access trojans using this sort of tactic in order to compromise victims. So my first question for you would be, what do you think makes OneNote so attractive to threat actors right now? Why are we seeing this surge in activity?
Yeah, sure. So it's somewhat of a new or somewhat different approach that threat actors would usually leverage. And I think due to that as well, being new, most end users, obviously they've received training and like, you know, what they should really inspect our attachments to emails. But it's a completely new approach in the sense that users will be opening these OneNote files. It's like they'll see something like OneNote is like, oh, this is fine. I'd usually expect to see like a weird image or an old Microsoft image or kind of pixelated and stuff like that. So it kind of adds that bit more of legitimacy, let's say. Like us as cybersecurity professionals, we're kind of looking at this like, how did you not see this, or how did you not see that? But we have to take a step back and realize it from the end user's perspective, that they mightn't pick up on things as we would.
Yeah, that's a great point to make. It's like, yeah, from Irony Tower in a way, like it's sort of easy to say, you know, that's obvious, but we work with this every day. So maybe it's not that obvious, especially because like internet users comes at, you know, ages and educational backgrounds and social backgrounds. So it's really, that's a really great point to make. And yeah, have we seen any sort of attacks abusing Microsoft OneNote in the past few weeks?
Yeah, we definitely have noticed an uptick in activity tied to those attachments, the OneNote attachments. And it's not subject to any particular malware loader. I think, to be honest, everybody's kind of jumping on it, like regardless of what group it is or whatever, they're all leveraging this because it has been quite successful.
Yeah.
And the main loader out of this that we have seen that's really kind of blown any other malware loader out of the park is Quackbot. So it, you know, it's really mechanized the OneNote in order to deliver its malware or its payloads.
Yeah, that's also like a really good point, because the fact that a lot of different malware strains are using this sort of technique to compromise organizations means that, of course, the popularity of this method works in a way. So it's successful because like when everyone is doing it, it's because it's simple and it pays off. That's what I think I've learned in the past experience that I had. So yeah, interesting to see this happening. And so we're saying that a lot of groups are using this. We're saying that a lot of organizations are being targeted this way. Do you have any sort of mitigation strategies or tips that you would recommend to organizations and individuals to sort of mitigate the threat posed by these sort of attachments?
Yeah, 100%. So they'd probably be best off blocking the likes of the .1 extensions via email security. And then obviously, you know, the go-to is always train the end users on, you know, new tactics that threat actors are using, you know, how to spot them and, you know, what to do with reported security, you know, delete the email, so on and so forth. But not only should organizations block the likes of .1 extensions, but also other extensions like disk image extensions, markup files, anything like that. Because with these loaders and with these kind of tactics, tractors are always continuously evolving and to go with the times. Like Microsoft, they're bringing out these drafter blocking macros by default. So the tractors see that and they're going to change to that and follow suit so that you can get into your environment. So that would be definitely one thing that I'd look at. Not just responding to each particular, say, trend, but looking at it as a whole and kind of stepping back and saying, what can we do better here?
Yeah, that's great. That's great advice. Thank you. Okay, I think we have covered everything in this section. So let's move to the third and final topic of this week. And this is going to be about DDoS attacks against NATO websites. So on Monday, it was reported that the Russian hacktivist collective Killnet carried out a series of DDoS attacks against NATO, causing temporary disruption to some of the military alliance's public-facing websites. So Killnet, I think we all know them by now, as we've talked about this group frequent times in the podcast, but is one of the main Russian-linked hacktivist groups that emerged following the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine war in February 2022. They often target Western entities. DDoS and effacement attacks are probably the preferred modus operandi when targeting organizations. But the fact that they've targeted and managed to compromise NATO websites is quite remarkable in itself. These attacks were previously announced on Killnet's Telegram channel, which is the channel that they use to cooperate these attacks and to publicly announce them before they happen. According to Stoltenberg, the NATO's classified networks have not been hit, but what has been hit was one of the networks used by NATO to cooperate the sort of support to the towns and victims of the earthquake in Syria and Turkey. So yeah, of course, that is definitely a critical target that was hit by Killnet. So as I mentioned before, Killnet is not new to these kind of attacks against Western entities, but how does this differ to what we've seen before?
I think like previously we've seen a lot of Killnet attacks on, like, they've been focusing on countries, individual countries, and then attacking like any organization or government website that they can find that's based in that country. So this shift to targeting NATO, the organization, is probably the biggest change, like, for them really focusing in on the organization and also just like attacking something that has a real world consequence as big as this. Like, it just shows like cyber criminals have no morals, and they are celebrating the fact that they are hindering efforts to try and save people that have been affected by the atrocities that the earthquake has brought.
And the fact that they managed to do that, well, we've seen Killnet like attacking and DDoSing like hospitals before, so that is not entirely new information to us, but I think the scale of the earthquake that just happened and the importance of this support just makes it sort of more apparent to the public eye, you know, because a DDoS attack against like a local hospital may still have really dire consequences, but may not be as publicly reported as this one. But this one, yeah, definitely has a bigger impact on the news, which in the end is what an activist group really want. If you try and think like them, what they want is publicity for their activity, because what they're trying to do is trying to put their ideology and their message out there as much as possible. So from their point of view, again, this is definitely like a pretty big success, because like we're talking about them, we're talking about what they want. So definitely a good point in there. But yeah, definitely a bad thing to happen.
It shows the warped ideology, though, doesn't it? Because they think that by us talking about it as a success, but actually, are they gaining supporters by affecting the earthquake relief efforts? I don't know, maybe some, but you would think that it actually puts them, sheds them in more of a bad light to a lot of people.
Yeah, and sorry, go on. Sorry,
Seth. No, go on, please.
And on that as well, like, I think we can kind of map out the difference between threat actors as well. Like, as you know, Ireland's the HSE health service system here was hit pretty badly. And I think at one point that the decrypted keys were essentially handed over to them because the threat actor group was actually getting bad publicity. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't looking good for their name at all. So I think in some senses, we are dealing with different threat actors, the ones that are trying to get their name out there and they don't care how we look at them. And then there is ones out there that are trying to kind of build a reputation that, you know, okay, we have impacted your environment, but you will get your files back. You will get X, Y, and Z once you pay up. I think it's very strange looking at that kind of point of view. Like, they're just looking to do damage. They don't really care. They don't have any, you know, thoughts about it. Like, I think you mentioned before, Steph, on a previous podcast about the attack on a German hospital in Dusseldorf, pretty sure, where someone actually died from it as well. So yeah. I don't think they realize the consequences of it, but I think it's just that's what we're dealing with. And that's why it is important that we do take threat actors seriously, regardless of whether we thought an attack was kind of a bit of a fail or whatever. They could come back around, they could tool up, and they could come back stronger and better.
Yeah, that's a really good point, especially the one about the Irish health service. And I think what happens with cyber criminals, may they be financially motivated or ideologically motivated, is that in a way they search for publicity because that strengthens their reputation, which means a lot for cyber criminal. But at the same time, they have to find a balance because if they are too much under the spotlight, usually what happens is not good news to them. So we've seen that with DarkSide, for example, with Colonial Pipeline. Great publicity, yes, but a few months later, they were taken down. Same things with Conti supporting Russia at the beginning of the war. So yeah, attacking NATO is definitely a dangerous endeavor for any cyber criminal there. And Brian, you just mentioned, you know, that we have to take seriously these threat actors. So my question for you would be, what is sort of the impact like of DDoS attacks, not just like in the short term, but like in the long term too, and how can you best mitigate against them?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose even just from the HSC's point of view, when they suffered that attack, they were just completely wiped out. So they were reduced to pen and paper. And that's not just subject to ransomware. If you do get DDoS, the same thing can happen as well. Your services could be down for God knows how long, and you are reduced to pen and paper. And the recommendations that I would recommend would be the likes of having DDoS mitigation tools in place, like Cloudflare, AWS, or Akamai. Apply ACLs so you can block unauthorized protocols outside of the trusted network, and do regular checks of your externally facing services. Obviously, we're hitting the DDoS is hitting your front services, so you'd want to make sure there's no vulnerabilities on those externally facing services or devices. Sorry, and that would be like looking for, say, RDP is open, SSH is open. These are just literally doors waiting to be opened for threat actors just to step in. So ACLs, mitigation tools for DDoS, and regular checks of your externally facing devices.
Cool, that's perfect. Thank you very much. Well, that marks the end of today's episode. If you've heard anything that you're curious about today, don't forget to check out the content available in the attachment section below. Before parting ways, I would like to congratulate Brian on his debut. You sounded like a veteran today, so really congrats. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, unless you're driving, give a round of applause to Ryan. And yeah, I'm looking forward to have you on board again in the coming weeks. You've really done a great job. So yeah, that's all for today. Thank you very much for listening, and bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.